Yeah, that's right. We're going to go down to shoot number four. Doesn't matter who the bull rider is because the bullfighter is Dusty Tuckness. So doesn't matter the bull, doesn't matter the scenario. He's going to step in the gap for you and for me because that's what he's known for. It's old Tuck. And we get the story of not only how he got started, but what he thinks it takes to be a bullfighter. So Dusty Tuckness is in the house on the Rodeo Time podcast. Check out DaleBrisby.com for the greatest brand known to man, Rodeo Time. That's the one right there.
That's the picture you're talking about. JR's podcast, wasn't it?
That's a cool picture. Oh, Slick Willie.
Oh, William. He's a good egg, man.
Yeah.
We drove from Tucson after short round 1 year all the way to Houston, me, him, and Koshel and Zeke, actually. That was the year Zeke actually wasn't in Houston, but he just rode Killer B, won Tucson, rode with me to Houston, and got to knowing each other. And I was like, dude, make sure you enter that thing because you never know.
Zeke rode Killer B?
Yeah, he won Tucson that year. And sure enough, Catherine, my old boss.
Yeah.
Hey, we need a bronc rider next set. And I was like, I got your guy. And then he turned around and wins Houston that year, too.
Dang.
That was pretty bad, eh?
Had he not entered?
He entered.
Yeah,
man, but he wasn't in because it was a rookie year, you know. Shoot, nobody knew Zeke yet. You know, obviously, they knew, you know, his history, family history. But
yeah,
sure enough, he entered and ended up getting in and winning it.
Because you got to enter
to
get that call back if somebody. How often are they calling people?
Houston, there's several calls every year, it seems like. I say several. There's a handful.
Just because?
Injuries or
Austin.
Something doesn't pan out or whatever, you know.
And now they got freaking I think they're going to change the date of the American.
Yeah, that's kind of part of it.
So you get guys that miss out and they can't go to something, so they'll call somebody.
Well, that's like O'Mara got in this year. I think somebody might have got hurt the first round. Yeah, O'Mara got in.
Really?
Yeah, somebody got.
I thought he was done.
No, I've actually seen him more this year than I've had in several years. So
I think
he's more sound, and I think, you know, with Kobe healthy and wanting to go, I mean, that guy's talented. He needs to, you know, very talented. Him and Radley and that them Louisiana boys they're pretty froggy.
Radley's his brother-in-law, though, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, that's a cool little dynamic. Get to go down the road with your brother-in-law.
Yeah,
that probably makes a So, where are you coming from? Where are you headed? What's going on in Tuck world?
Just left the house. Got back from Wichita, Kansas last weekend for a Velocity PBR. At the house a few days doing the old spring cleaning and en route to College Station and then to the Velocity Finals in Corpus and then followed by the WCRA rodeo the next week in Corpus. So, we'll be down in Corpus for about 10 days.
What town do you live in again?
The address is Wanette. It's kind of, I could say, just east of Purcell.
Yeah, gotcha.
Most people know where Purcell's at-ish.
Most people, if I'm not most people, where's Purcell?
southeast of Oklahoma City, about 45 minutes.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
Southeast. You drive right through Purcell before you get to Norman, the more than Oklahoma City.
Yeah. American hats. You know why? Because I'm an American. I'm not a communist. I would be also wearing their t-shirt or a cap because I'm on a podcast. I got these headphones on, but they don't sell those. All they sell, all they make are cabo hats because they're cabos. And if you want to be one, wear an American hat. Total Feeds. That's who is powering Woe Boone. 23 years old. He just turned 23. We still pick up on him. We still ranch on him. Total Feeds has him looking and feeling amazing. That's all he gets, by the way. 8 pounds at least. Most of the time we feed him 10. Good clean water, 8 to 10 pounds of Total Feeds per day. That's what he's been on for years. That's what powers all the horses. Thank you, Total Feeds, for keeping us going. What circuit is it? Prairie Circuit.
Yeah, that'd be Prairie Circuit.
Prairie Circuit. Yeah. So when are those? Do you get the Prairie Circuit's finals?
I've been selected years ago, but I was already had obligations to another circuit. So it's different for us and contestants where contestants, you can, you can go to less rodeos if your address is in that circuit, or you can claim another one. You got to go to more, or we just, you know, for, we can mark all 12 circuits for our name to be on the ballot as long as we work 8 rodeos and 20 performances in the year. But I just, I'll mark down the circuits that I work. So there's about six to seven circuits that I'll put my, or check the box on so I can be on the ballot.
You bet.
So I, you know, I kind of like to, would go somewhere where I'm actually working some rodeos in that circuit is why I don't mark all the boxes, but
right.
Yeah.
So talking about your circuit, let's back up to your story.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you and I haven't talked specifically about this. Everybody knows Dusty Tuckness. You know, when you hear that name, you think of some of those crazy saves. You think of the NFR, you think of, you know, Cheyenne and Houston. But back us up to like when that picture wasn't in anybody's head yet.
The part that a lot of people don't know.
Right.
I'd say the biggest thing is it's just my, pretty much my testimony. Growing up as a kid, my parents were divorced at a young age, so I don't really recall any of that. I grew up in Idaho, small town, Du Bois. Me and my three brothers, and we were avid to being in the outdoors, sports. I wasn't necessarily the athletic kid. I was kind of the chunky, short guy. Kind of grew into my skin. But in 96, I believe it was, Dad called and asked if I could, would want to go rodeoing with him. And I was just something that I stuck to and I wanted to, and Mom supported it. And I thought I was traveling across the country, and
yeah,
we went to Montana. I think the furthest I was actually away from the house was 6 hours, and rodeoed with him for about 6 weeks, and I just loved it. I truly fell in love with the game. I was old enough to understand it a little bit more.
And he was a barrel man.
Yeah, he rode in events as well, but his biggest thing was fighting bulls and working the barrel.
Okay, gotcha.
And, man, I just truly did fall in love with the sport. And the next handful of years through junior high, you know, when I'd come back to go to school and that, like, I had a great family life with my mom and my stepdad and my brothers, but I just, man, it was hard. It got harder on me every summer to leave Dad and be away from rodeo, and it was like 9 months before I ever got to, you know, really partake in it again. And coming into just before that, when I started, you know, fighting bulls and working bulls and getting more involved with it. And, you know, I can honestly say I didn't know what fears or nerves or anything was at a young age, because growing up with two older brothers, you know, to be involved with anything they're doing, you kind of had to be tough. You know, yeah. I was raised by a tough stepdad, you just kind of had to, you kind of had to get along to go along. And
yeah.
So I started fighting bulls a little bit, and I just said fear, nerves, nothing. That was not a part of my world. And I got in a pretty bad wreck coming in after my freshman year. So kind of back up just a little bit. There's a transition in my life from junior high to high school. We were fixing to be at that time of year to go back to Mom's and that, and I just I asked Dad if I could live with him, and he said, absolutely, but, you know, you've got to make that call, and, you know, your mom's got to support it. And long story short on that, you know, some of the hardest things, or one of the hardest things that I ever had to do in my life, turned into being the best thing in my life. And where I'm going with that, I moved in with Dad, started working some more events and that, and then just after my freshman year, I was working a rodeo. And
so when your freshman year of high school, 14-ish,
mm-hmm.
When did you fight your first bull? How old were you?
Oh, golly, 11, 12.
Yeah.
Yeah, just, I was pretty young, yeah. Doing them junior rodeos. And
right.
And then the sneaking off to practice pens, you know, that's
yeah.
One thing. The Fiddleback Ranch there in Metitzi, there's a big money guy there that built an indoor-outdoor arena and bought a bunch of bulls. And at that time, Tony Mendez, Rob Smits, and them were sponsored by him, and we'd sneak out there and with Scotty Brown, and first I'd start, you know, I was just watching, and then I was working the outgate, and then I was latching, and then next thing yep. you know, I was fighting bulls,
yeah.
and And that's kind of how I cut my teeth. And, you know, dad and everybody kind of found out. And they really didn't try to direct me from it. They supported it a bit. And then, you know, there was a solid year and a half of that, you know, for sure. And then started working a few other events. And
yeah, so now we're back to
just after my freshman year. I was working an event and I got in a pretty bad wreck. And for the first time in my life, I really understood what the sport can and could do to me. Had a bull hem me up against the buck and shoots and or the outgate and knocked me out, bust a couple of ribs, bust my chin. And, you know, when I come to, I can remember going across like the dirt pasture in an ambulance. And, you know, I didn't see dad, anybody that I knew. So really struck me pretty hard and heavy. Obviously, you get to the hospital at that point and doctors talking to you. You know, you're the tough rodeo guy, man. I got hooked. You know, no big deal, you know. And a couple weeks later, I was in the stands watching the bull ride in Baker, Montana. And that bull that hurt me come bucking out of the chutes. And for the first time in life, I can really remember fear hitting me.
Dang.
And like I was scared in the stands. And it was a big movement in my life, I guess, just to see what the sport could be all about. And dad used to put on an event in Cody, so coming into that following May, you know, he was going to have me work it with Jess Griffin and Sean Penrod, and I was going to be the third guy. And I can remember 2 weeks out, I was already nervous, you know, kind of excited. You know, the week of, I was really starting to get nervous. And, you know, we get to the bull ride, and the very first bullet bucks out. He goes out there and turns back a few and bucks the guy off, and I step to him, and I just remember locking eyes to him, and it just locked me in my tracks, literally locked me in my tracks. And I wish I could find this picture because I think it'd be funny to look back on, but there's an old picture of this bull jumping and kicking across the pin. He's probably 30 feet from the buck and shoot, and I'm on the top rail, right? I was literally that scared, and honestly, I had to leave the arena the rest of the bull ride.
And you're 13 at this time.
No, at this point, you know, I'm end of freshman, just before sophomore year, I think, somewhere around there.
So solid 14, maybe getting into 15.
Yeah. So I was still pretty young, but again, I just had a real big eye opener at a young age of the sport and the injuries, and you know these animals are really powerful and strong, and
yeah.
I remember having to leave the arena for the rest of the bull ride, and I went and hit in the corner on the right-hand delivery sides at the Cody Stampede Grounds, and I didn't want to be around anybody, but I knew I couldn't stand in the arena. Like, I just
– dang.
It was just too much for me, and they started doing a rodeo Bible camp there and at the Fiddleback you know, that following year, and I wanted to go to it, not necessarily for the godly stuff, but – it was a chance for me to fight bulls and, you know, try to get over this hurdle in my life. And I didn't know at that point what that camp was going to do to my life. But, you know, going back to the hardest thing in my life that I had to do is call my mom. And as a mother's love, when you're calling her saying, I more or less don't want to live with you anymore, I want to live with dad, you know, that's got to strike hard. And but it was through that transition and that movement to my dad's, which allowed me to go to this camp. And at that camp, you know, my goal and incentives of going were to work on my craft and fighting bulls, but, you know, totally changed my life. I gave my life to God and really started seeing the big picture of the purpose that I have, you know, my creator, and there's more to life than just this. And it was from that turning point on where things started to click. You know, I started understanding who I was, what I'm capable of doing, but ultimately, you know, controlling my thoughts and believing in myself and the process and the work ethic. And from there, it was, you know, started, you know, twinkling away at some events that dad would help me get, you know, some little pumpkin rollers here and there. And
yeah,
and then it just kind of started getting a little bit more. And then I would say more or less my big break, because I didn't grow up around where there was rodeos and bulls all over, you know, there's the night rodeo around, but I was still a little bit young to dive off into that. But as we started getting into high school, started doing some high school rodeos and some college events, and, you know, that peace started coming over me, mm-hmm. and I started kind of forgetting about the nerves and the fear and everything, and just like I said, ultimately understanding who I was created to be and what I was created to do. And I dedicate that to, you know, that camp, and just, you know, God, you know, coming into my life, or me allowing God into my life.
So that camp, was it, you're around 14, somewhere 14, 15. I'm sure it wasn't just an overnight switch from, like, you can't be in the arena to Dusty Tuckness we know today.
No.
How much time did it take to kind of transition to, I guess maybe like a paralyzing fear to more of a respect fear that you were still able mm-hmm. to move forward?
It took a good while. I can remember it was probably a year after that school. Dad had an event that he was hired to work in Red Lodge, Montana, and he took the job with them agreeing to let me be in the arena with him and mm-hmm. and the other guy. And it's kind of funny, kind of cliche, but I can remember kind of being a little bit nervous for it. And we were standing there just as the grand entry and that was going on, and Dad just looked at me and said, "Son, if you're going to do this, you might as well try to be the best." And I could remember that like that was yesterday. And I remember that moment right there. I was like,
"And you were how old then?"
Probably right into my sophomore year.
Okay, gotcha.
Yep. And I can remember at that moment that there was a little bit of transition, a little bit of a mental change.
Yeah.
And I remember going in there. I worked a hang up and felt like I made a couple rounds of some bulls, more or less, probably just touched them and got away. And then the next probably year and a half into my junior year is when I really started seeing some development. I started getting Jim Ivory actually was doing the stock and the contracting at the Night Rodeo at the time. And I think I had about 8 weekends for him.
Yeah.
And so I would really say probably junior year is where I really started feeling that transition of, you know, the respect value over outweighing the fear factor. And I just kept kind of nitpicking it and started getting more events, more rodeos, kind of traveling a little bit. And then
felt like you were rodeoing.
Yeah, exactly. I was just pretty much in Wyoming and southern Montana. But I really started to see the change then.
Did you feel like, so let's say you're 16, 17, circling back 5 to 6 years prior to that, when you start getting in the arena with bulls, cracking latches, did you feel like, I mean, you're 17 years old, but did you feel like you were still behind or late? Or did you know like, I haven't even graduated high school, I'm ahead of the game? Because looking back, I'm sure you probably think like, man, I was so young. But I feel like most people, whether they're 17, 22, 27, like there's a lot of people that feel like they're behind. So how did you address that? Or did you even feel?
And I think I'm still too young to really to comprehend that, you know, of, you know, am I doing my job? Am I doing it right? Am I too late? Am I too early? Am I in the way?
Well, I mean, like, just in your career.
Oh, in my career.
Yeah, I'm not talking about, like, in a gap. I'm talking about, like, because there's a lot of people that are like, they feel like they see someone younger than mm-hmm. them that might be better at that point in time, and so it makes them feel like they're behind.
Yeah, and to be honest, still at that point in my life, I wouldn't necessarily say I even really considered it as a full-time career, you know.
Gotcha.
Coming from a small town, and I remember watching all the bullfight tapes and that when I was young, and Rex of schools and that, and Oklahoma seemed like it was a continent away. Mm-hmm. I really didn't do a whole lot of traveling, so I don't think it really set in that this is going to be a full-time career and commitment until probably the first full summer after my senior year.
So you up to that point, you didn't have any expectations. You were just having fun.
Man, I did. I'm not saying I didn't, because, man, you watch the NFR, and back then you didn't have DVR or anything. You had to stay up late on school nights and watch it. So, yes, I had, I guess, goals or dreams in a sense, but I didn't, I guess, really comprehend to a really deep level at that young of an age yet.
Yeah.
You know, you wanted to be in Vegas, you wanted to meet certain people, or you wanted to fight a certain bull, you know. Those are always visions of mine, and, you know, I've countless hours of fighting the dog and working dad's barrel out in the yard, just imagining being at the finals or imagining fighting Crooked Nose or whatever. But I don't think it really set in that, hey, I think I want to do this full time, full career, put everything in the basket that I have, probably until right after my senior year in high school. And I say that because I didn't get or put in for my card when I was 18. And you know, to have your PRSA card, you got to be at least 18. Yeah. I waited a full year. Yeah. I waited till I was 19. And I told myself that, you know, Maury Tate out of Oklahoma, Maury Nicky Tate, they got the rodeo in 2005, and Cody. And he ended up hiring me for the full summer. And I just told myself, I've got 93 performances in a row here. If at the end of the summer I'm still craving it like I am now, then I know that I'm ready. Yeah. And then I want this. And so it was kind of a bet to myself in a sense of, if I can withstand three straight months of fighting bulls every night, and you've been to Wyoming before, you'll get every kind of weather, every kind of bull rider, every kind of bull, every kind of situation that I wanted to put in for my card. And at the middle of August, I still was craving it more than ever, and ended up putting in the last five performances at the night rodeo in for my evaluation dates. And you know, I could still remember Shane Proctor was actually the first guy that told me I got my card.
Dang.
And so that was pretty cool because we went to college together. And so, but yeah, it was really after my senior year when I was like, if I withstand this summer and I still want it as bad as I do now, January 1st to August 31st, then I'm entered.
So you're 19. Had you done, how much freestyling had you done up to that point?
That's funny you say that. It was me and Austin Ashley were actually watching some old school film last night at my house. And my actual first full blood Mexican that I ever fought was in the NFR Buckenstock cell in 2005.
Which you'd have been how old then?
19.
So that summer.
Yeah. So I fought some half bloods or mean bucking bulls and whatnot, and took several hookings by that point. But the first full-blood Mexican that I ever fought was at the NFR cell in 2005. And then I got an invite to go to Tulsa, Oklahoma for the Dickies National Championship qualifier bullfight. And that was going to be with Rex Dunn Bulls. And I was going to meet Rex for the first time. I think that was my first plane ticket that I actually bought. I was living a high life. Now I'm not in Wyoming anymore. Dang. And then I won the event. And then from there, my very next event, Rex Dunn called me to invite me to ADA for the World Championship bullfights, and which then the next week after that I had the Dickies Finals bullfights in Las Vegas. So my first three bullfights were
bam, bam, bam,
bam, bam, bam, and like I said, I didn't have a lot of fighting bulls or calves or cows underneath me before. I was just, like I said, I was kind of the school of hard knocks is how I come up. And you know, you kind of figured out what did and what didn't work. You know, there wasn't a lot of schools back then.
Did you have a mentor?
I'd say ultimately dad would have been that.
Yeah.
You know, he was the biggest, I think, reason that really directed me this way. I truly feel this is God's plan for my life, but he was the incentive to directing that. But growing up, man, I really liked Smets, Miles Hare, Lance.
So those, your dad, did they all, sorry, I've got so many questions, but your mindset on freestyling was, I guess your dad's was probably similar to yours. And that's one of the things that helped formed it. Cause it sounds like you've always been, cause there's two schools in, you know, bullfighting community. There's mm-hmm. some guys that, you know, freestyle and cowboy protection. Then you've got a group of guys that kind of, they just want to do cowboy protection and they're pretty salty towards freestyle.
Yeah.
And you're in the group of like, hey, let's fight them all, freestyle and cowboy protection. And so it sounds like that's been since day one.
Yeah, I mean, growing up as a kid, I watched the Ring of the Bullfights. Yeah. You know, there's world champions, you know, and you were chasing the gold buckle just like any other rodeo athlete. So, but for me, I think at the end of the day, it was just that I was a bullfighter. And it didn't matter if it was a guy on the back of the bull or if it was a competition. Like, I just, at that point in my life, I was like, this is what I want to do. I'd probably say earlier on in my career, if you want to call it that, early high school, seeing the world championship race to the gold buckle, I was always dreaming of, you know, chasing that and being a part of that. But I think ultimately it was, you know, you could talk to Maury Tate, and there's countless times that he'd cuss me or get on to me for overfighting his bulls because I wanted action. I was just craving it. And I just, you know, if a bull jumped out and didn't do anything, like, I'd chase him down and, you know, make him do something, you know, kick me or whatever. And so I think the simplicity of it for me was I was a bullfighter. It didn't matter if you wanted me to fight him or protect a guy. I mean, I was there.
Yeah. And that's gotten you way more jobs than the other group in the bullfighting community that doesn't want to do that. Do you agree?
Yeah, I believe that. I tell a lot of kids to this day of you don't have to be a freestyle guy, you know, or just a protection guy or whatever. I said maybe if you do want to be more of a protection guy, that's fine, but don't be against, you know, going to some bullfights.
Yeah.
You know, just to cut your teeth at them, or don't stress over the fact, or don't book something because you got to sell a rodeo with the fighting bull. You know, there's definitely bullfight events that I participated in that helped get me jobs. You know, guys saw me at some bullfights in Denver one year. It was the first time I ever landed the backflip, and, you know, ended up getting Greeley's Extreme Bulls out of it, and then Fort Collins Rodeo out of it.
It's a pretty dang good job interview.
Yeah, I mean, it can be, you know, and I think,
hey, I'd like to fight your rodeo, and then you go do a backflip.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, they're like, okay, yeah, you're probably qualified.
Well, I can remember going into the NFR cell, and what was cool about the NFR cell back then in 2005 is it was still at the Thomas and Mack. So you kind of got to experience.
Yeah, yes.
The actual atmosphere.
I have a hoodie, and Lord, I hope I can find it. It's the 2005. It says NFR 2005.
Okay.
My dad went there, got on a bronc at the stock sale.
In 2005?
In 2005, and bought some bucking horses that year, like or three.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was cool.
And
I need to figure out. So he sold them. He sold a bunch of bucking horses to Bubba Miller, and then Bubba Miller. They're pretty much all gone except for one named Budweiser. And Bubba gave that one back to me. It's at my house right now. I'm trying to remember if Budweiser came from that stock sale. Anyways.
That's cool.
Continue.
I just remember going there, being in the Thomas and Mack in Vegas. I'm actually going to fight bulls. And, you know, I can remember Hollywood Yates was there. Shorty Gorm was working the finals that year. He walked up. There's a handful of them guys that I dang sure looked up to in the sport of bullfighting because that's what you saw on TV or on those tapes. And I can remember
who was fighting the finals that year.
It was Shorty and Deef.
Yeah.
Yep. Shorty and Deef.
Yeah. Cause there was like, what was it, like 73 years in a row that Deef worked it or something?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. But he worked it a lot.
Both him and Joe Bumgarner, they worked it several years. But I could just remember him telling me that, hey, go to everything. Don't take a bull off. And I did. I just took that to heart. And is every contractor's there, a lot of different personnel's there. And, you know, it's in a rotation format. So you'd work, I think, five bulls, and then you'd sit out. And, you know, you'd work five more and sit out. And then they used to do a freestyle with it. You know, they'd fight five each night. And I was up the first night, but I fought everything. Every bull rider bucked off. I'd trail them all around.
Yeah.
Help them bulls in and out of the arena. It just showed people that I was willing to go above and beyond. And then the next day, there was actually two fighting bulls that guys didn't want to fight. So there was two open ones, but they had to sell them. And so I said, I'll enter. You know, I'm entered. You know,
yeah.
I won't compete for it. But, yeah, so I ended up calling for some more and just fighting everything I possibly could and just really trying to take full advantage of the opportunity that was at stake. And I truly feel that, you know, that's benefited me as well as all the other bullfights and competitions that I've done throughout the year.
And then I understand also, like, you get to a certain point, and I think there's probably half a dozen, maybe a dozen of y'all out there, that you get a string of rodeos, like, for instance, Tucson, Houston, Cheyenne, the NFR, five, six other ones, like that, like what you have. And you got a pretty full schedule, and you may not enter as many freestyle bullfights. They ask you to sell one, like at Fort Worth, you guys sell one every perf, like you'll do it and you're excited to, and it's part of the game. But strategically, you get to a point where you may not play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, LeBron doesn't play very many pickup basketball games.
Yeah, Yeah, no, exactly. Like, you know, when I was young, and I tell everybody to this day, is if you're open, you know, don't look at it necessarily as a, oh man, it's got 20,000 added. Like, it's an investment. You're investing in your product.
Mm-hmm.
So the more people you can get in front of, word of mouth goes further than what you can say about yourself. And
right.
So I'd go to everything I could, anything that I could enter or financially get to, I'd go to. And then on the freestyle part, you know, I was coming down to ADAs for several years, and then I'd do some little oddball bullfights here and there. And then, you know, then I finally got into Salinas, and then there was a stretch of, I don't know, 3 to 4 years there where there was some bullfights out there, but not many.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't really go to much. And then BFO come around, and I wanted to dedicate myself at least 3 years to it, you know, mm-hmm. to help, you know, build a brand, help showcase the sport again. There was like 10 or 12 of us in that group, and, you know, start getting a depth chart together with some younger guys and drawing some interest. And so I competed in the BFO for the first full 3 years, and it was hard still because of my rodeo schedule. But what did help a lot of that was there were several of those events that were tied into events that I already had. So we'd have a five-man bullfight on the Extreme Bulls night, so I'd work 40, 50 head of bulls and then fight a Mexican.
Yeah.
Or somewhere on the rodeo perf. So that allowed me to still go to 6 to 8 events a year, and then there's a couple standalones throughout the year that I was open for that I could go to and compete. But I haven't actually entered a competition bullfight in, I don't know, since Cody 2000 and 4 years ago, whatever that would be, 2020, 2021.
If you're looking for an everyday rancher kind of side-by-side, that's Can-Am. The Defender Pro is what I like to drive around. We've also got a Defender with a 6-foot bed. Can fit everything. T-post, your post-hole diggers, the cedar stays, dozens of bags of feed, actually. We can put a round bale of hay in the back of this side-by-side. I've not ever even heard of that before. Check out Can-Am. Thank you, Can-Am, for keeping us going on Radiator Ranch. I hope this podcast has been an energy drink for your ears, just like Mountain Ops is an energy drink for my life. I try to take Ignite in the mornings, the BCAAs during a workout, the Magnum protein afterwards, Slumber at night to help me get in that deep sleep and stay there. So check out mountainops.com. Pow, pow. So back up to the buck and stock sale in 05. You win that deal, mm-hmm. I'm assuming.
Yes, sir.
And then you take off to do some pro rodeos. What'd you do that first year? What'd you work?
Yeah, so then I already had a little bit of a relationship, standing relationship with the Kesslers. That's what Dad used to do, kind of his summer run in Montana. And so,
because you had been with your dad so much.
Yeah, been with my dad. And so they ended up hiring me for their summer run. And then outside of that, I had a couple of open bull ridings and just bullfights. I didn't have much of a schedule. Then first, let's see, 06, 07, first couple of years I didn't have much. I had a little bit in the summer, you know, a little one here and there in the winter, and maybe one in the fall, but it was just a starting point, the building foundation, I guess, for my career. And then obviously, like I said, when bullfights come up, went to them. And then for about 3 to 4 years there was the PBF, the Daisy Protection Protection Association, I guess you'd call it. And so we'd go to a lot of them, and those were in conjunction with a lot of bull ridings. I think there were some ABBI events, some PBR events, some touring pros, NBBAs, and all that. Yeah. So I went and competed to them for a solid 2 years. Myself and my partner, Andy Burrell, we ended up winning that championship 2 years in a row. And that filled in a lot of those dates, made some more contacts to that. And then my first big event, I would say, would be Cody's Extreme Bulls. Got that. And then ended up getting Salinas that same year to go to the bullfights. Just slowly kind of chipped away at them. I can remember my first Benny Butler event that I got. I heard that he was needing a bullfighter for Oklahoma City in 2007, and so I called Benny, and I said, Mr. Butler, this is Dusty Tuckness, and I heard that you may need a bullfighter this weekend in Oklahoma City. And he says, Dusty, who?
Yeah.
So, anyways, he gave me the chance, and I want to take full advantage of it. And, you know, Benny's old school. And
so you were asking to just work the rodeo?
Yeah, well, it was Extreme Bulls and like a three-day rodeo. And they would have three for the Extreme Bulls and just two for the rodeo, and he needed one more for the
– yeah.
And so I just made the call, and luckily he gave me the chance, and I – like I said, took full advantage of it. I fought everything that he's pointed at. And
was he the kind of stock contractor that didn't want you out there too long?
No, not really. You know, he was kind of fight or flight type deal. And I can remember they had one bull. It was bar 206. I'm cranky. He was this little white bull, a spinner, a nice little bull, probably 21 point spinner, but he was mean.
Yeah.
And back then, when there's three guys in the arena, there was no three man. You know, it was two in, one out.
Mm.
And I was out, quote unquote, out on 206. And I remember Benny walking by me. He said, "Son, just stay back and let these boys work this one." And I took that as like, that's not happening. And as soon as he dumped that guy off, they rolled him, and I bailed off in there to him and wrapped him up and just was like, let him know that I'm here. I'm not just here trying to pull a paycheck or say I'm going to be a bullfighter. I want to prove it. And
oh, he thought you might get hurt.
Well, he just, you know, yeah, son, you know, this.
That it was that first show.
First one.
Gotcha.
Yep,
okay.
That I thought, had for him. Yep.
Yeah. I thought you meant maybe he knew you were aggressive and he didn't want
No, he didn't know me from Adam.
Oh, you
know,
and like so he said, was like, I don't want this new guy. I'm going to let these seasoned vets handle this.
Kind of deal.
And you had to go in and.
Yeah. And
how did he react to that?
Was good. It was good, man, because obviously outside of that, I, you know, Benny, a lot of his committees, you know, hold a lot of value to what he says and his thoughts. So, and he, you know, obviously put my name in the hat at several events and ended up getting a handful in the next couple of years after that. Yeah. And just always had a good staying relationship with Benny.
That's the exact mindset of, I think that when you shift over to the I only do cowboy protection, I don't freestyle, that. And there's always exceptions to the rule. I'm not just targeting, you know, but most of those guys are not going to, if it's two in and one out and they're the one out, they ain't going in there after.
Yeah. Especially that's that mindset. Crazy.
Yeah. They ain't going in there.
Yeah.
If it's especially if it's one of the, you know, 206 and he's got a reputation and somebody goes, does this deal.
Yeah.
With the two fingers on your hand, like, look out for this. Like, okay.
Yeah.
But, anyway, that's where I think, because that there's no telling how much, you know, the kind of impact that had to impress a guy. You know, you'd already done that with Kessler, with Maury Tate, and now Benny Butler. Like, those are three pretty big names in the industry, especially in 2007. Mm-hmm. And so, like, if you're impressing them, that's a pretty good foundation because, like you said, like, word of mouth travels fast. Like, if you go to get a job, like, all they need is one conversation with Benny.
Yeah.
They don't need, you know, they're not going to go call your dad and all these, you know, references you give them. Like, they talk to Benny. That's game on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think that goes back, kind of forgot to touch on it. There was a winter series in Laurel, Montana, up by Billings when I was in college. And they do it, I don't know, it was like 3 months out of the winter. And it was a Friday night bull riding, Saturday rodeo, and then Sunday junior rodeo. And back in college, man, I was barely getting by, you know, as you know, making ends meet, but I really wasn't making much money. And so we'd go up there to a friend's house and build fence all day, and then I'd go fight bulls at night. And a lot of those times, I was by myself. I was a solo bullfighter.
Dang.
Very rarely there was two of us, and there was two contractors.
Rarely was there a second one that knew what he was doing.
Yeah, exactly. And I was still, like I said, young in my walk with it too, but there's two contractors there that were pretty old school, pretty hardcore, and definitely had earned their respect. But John Pinkerton and Trevor Walker, they had a lot of good bulls, but they were always pretty notorious for hooking somebody too. So, you know, they beat me up quite a bit at the Horse Palace. You know,
dang.
I was too young and dumb to really know any different, but I kept coming back and, you know, kept, you know, yes sir, no sir, and trying to do my job. And I think that helped me out a lot too, especially not only being the only bullfighter, but coming up through a lot of bulls that, you know, really weren't patterned and really, really on the fight a lot too. So I credit a lot of that to, you know, where I'm at today, as well as the, through the protection matches and then the longevity through the night rodeos. And, you know, just like I said, coming up through the School of Hard Knocks is kind of how we really come up. And it's cool to see where the evolution of the sport has come today.
Yeah. So how many, what year did you make your first NFR?
2009.
So really just 2 full years as a PRCA card holder. What was it that you did in 2009 that you think that really helped delineate you as one of the top three going?
Well, 2008 was a close year. We ended up being an alternate in 2008. He's back. That was the last year they actually just had two guys. 2008. So I
in a normal year now, you'd have made it in 2008.
Yeah. Yeah, so gotcha. In 2008, I still had to go and show up. They got me room. I still got paid. It was only like $250 a night to sit on the fence, suited out and ready.
Dang.
And
then it was Deef and...
Deef and Kelly. Well, actually, it was... Deef ended up getting hurt a month and a half or so before the NFR. So it ended up being Corey and... Kelly Jennings and Clay Collins.
Gotcha.
And with me as an alternate.
Man, was that Clay Collins' first year?
Yep, 07.
I remember I was in Seguin at that deal, and I remember him walking up in his red hat and telling somebody, I got the NFR. Yeah. Anyway, Clay Collins, I didn't know Kelly.
Yeah, Kelly was like the first PRCA bullfighter I really actually got to know.
Gotcha.
He's from Idaho, and you know, I'm from there as well, but he was just a great guy, just a cattle savvy, just a cowboy. But I can remember that year I had just a couple events that helped me. I had Oklahoma City, the bullfights at Salinas, and Cody's Extreme Bulls were like my three kind of main events that helped me get to that point. And I just remember sitting on the fence, you know, that year. That was the best worst year almost in a sense of getting a little taste of it, but it was all right. Now this next year, I don't want to be in this position. And, I was thankful that coming into 2009, that would have been, I ended up getting Phillipsburg, Kansas, Fort Worth, actually San Antonio was trying to hire me. I got Houston's contract because I went down there and did a little Shodio bullfight. And then a couple other contracts, all off of, you know, what 08 brought me, as well as you know, convention stuff. So 2009 was really looking up. That was actually the year I got to the Ram Finals, which was in Pocatello. Dang. At the time. So it was a big year, started up. I was so excited and ready, and really just hit the ground running, and again taking every advantage that I had, taking each rodeo as it come. And it was, I don't know, it's crazy to think, because the feeling that I got in 2009, it really hasn't shifted at all to today on, you know, working the events and then coming to that time of year, you know, when they start voting and you start hearing things. And it was nerve-wracking, like it is every year. But once I actually got the call for the first one, it was just it was really cool. And what's really cool about it is a good friend of mine, Chance Smart, the year before.
Also from Wyoming.
No, that's Cannon. You're thinking Cannon Acey.
Oh, I thought Chance was from Mississippi. Was too. Oh, okay.
Yeah. But
that makes more sense, because he was really
texted
redneck.
Me a Bible verse the day after I found out I was an alternate. It was Galatians 6:9. It said, "Don't grow weary for doing good, but for in proper time you'll reap a harvest if you do not give up." And just to kind of see that verse full circle come around, coming to the next year, and that was pretty humbling. It was just such a blessing. And we were in Belleville, Texas. Maury Nicky's rodeo and Boyd Paul Hamus. I mean, you know how you can just drop it like it's hot.
Yeah.
And they go to do the intros for the bullfighters for the bull ride, and he goes on the spill, you know, this kid living a dream, and he's finally achieved it, you know, from Tietze, Wyoming. Dusty Texas will make his first appearance, you know.
That's how you found out?
That's how I found out.
Dang.
And like,
that's
I was keeping
super
it together.
Cool.
I was keeping it together. I was doing pretty good, and I looked up in the announcer stand, and Nikki Tate, kind of like my second mom, she's balling. And then I lost it right there in Belleville. But it was a pretty cool moment, pretty sentimental moment, and something I'll always remember.
That was in 09.
Yep.
Dang. That's wild. Mm-hmm. What a way to find out.
Yeah, pretty cool.
I mean, that's crazy just because, like, that in and of itself is such a neat. I mean, like, getting a call is awesome, but, like, especially Boyd, Maury Tate, Chance was there.
I believe Chance was. Cannon might have even been there, too. Yeah. And just a good, you know, core group that was there that it really built the situation up for what it was. And it was cool. Like I said, it was something I'll always remember. And like I said, every year it doesn't lose its taste, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. So that was 2009, and you've been every year since.
Yeah, Lord willing, we were. Yeah, it's been a blessed career so far, and still got a lot to go.
Is that 13 in a row?
14.
14, yeah, because it includes the – gotcha. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dang. That's wild. Is that the longest stretch that anyone's had?
Yeah. Joe had 13 consecutive and 14 total and consecutive. Yeah, I'm overall tied with Joe.
Right, gotcha.
Now. Yes, sir.
So, man, walking into the Thomas and Mack 2009 compared to the 14th year.
Man, it doesn't change. Obviously, this last year had some different feels from it from 2021 when I ended up breaking my leg.
Right.
And walking back in there for the first time was pretty sentimental. It was
being able to overcome that.
Yeah, just to overcome that adversity and you know, the goal that I set to myself when they were packing me out was I don't want this to define me from ever coming back here. And
yeah.
And when we stepped foot in that dirt for the first time, you know, the following year was pretty emotional. And just like I said, that feeling doesn't go away. The taste doesn't taste any different. If anything, it's more sweet. And then to be able to share it with so many great people, you know, I got to work it several times with Diefenbach, who I admire and looked up to, and, you know, with Clay and Kenny and Kelly, and, you know, now with several years with Webster and, you know, Nathan Harp and Justice and Ferg and Chuck and all them guys, Evan, you know, it's been cool to experience with that and redo this year. So I just, everything that Deef and Kelly and them ministered to me, you know, I want to be able to help give that, you know, down to the younger generation as well. And like I said, it's just something that you can't really script it, you know. Even if you're just a fan to go out to Vegas, you kind of got to go experience it to know what we're talking about. But to walk down that tunnel, to be on that dirt and see some of the things that I've got to see on that dirt and the bull rides that have been made and just the atmosphere in that arena is just, man, there's no words that can describe it.
What major changes have you seen in the fundamentals of bullfighting through those years? Because you name all those individuals dating back to Deef and going back to, like, you know, Smets and some of them guys. Well, freestyle, a lot's gone on. So the Wrangler bullfights went away and bullfights were kind of popular back then. And then there was a stretch where it was just here and there and then BFO and UBF and all these other bullfights and, you know, all these names that you've named, like, those are great bullfighters. So you've seen them all, you've worked with them all, NFR 14 times. Do you see any, like, major changes to the actual fundamentals? So, like, maybe, like, where, how you stand before, prior to the bull ride, or the way you work in with three guys? Like, are there any of those kind of
changes? I think your core set of fundamentals are the same, you know, with just your basics and no different than rope and ride or anything. Your basics, I don't think really change. But then the development off that, definitely, I think, has changed and fine-tuned more, especially when you're talking about the three-man, the triangle, the blender, if you want to call it that, and just the whole natural flow of the whole situation and the just overall studying of the art of bullfighting, of what can have a higher percentage of letting this be more of a safer environment or less chance of a wreck. And
yeah,
it goes back to a lot of film study and watching, slowing down. You know, for me, it's a lot of hip placement. You know, a lot of times, you know, where a guy's going by the direction of their hips, you know, their lead foot. So when I'm working with somebody and in my peripherals, if I see their hips are faced this way, I know that I'm going to probably change my hips to go back this way, and I'm going to trust him to go ahead and feel that, and then I'm going to try to pull off of him. And so I think just the overall studying of the whole craft has definitely evolved to a different level, where before the fundamentals I think were the same, but it was a little more not as controlled or as smooth as it can be to the, to it is today.
So transitioning from two to three, what kind of resistance was there in the bullfighting community? Were there a lot of people that really felt like three was too many?
Yeah, I think probably at the start for sure. And I'm still a believer. And if you got two good guys, they can do just as good job as with three good guys. To the difference between the two and the three, if you're just two guys and one guy's really not holding his load, you're not really crossing each other up, or you know, you can stay a little more sound. Where in a three man, if you got two guys that know what they're doing and one guy that doesn't know the flow or read and react and on a split second, that can cause some, you know, wrecks or the flow kind of, you know, mishap and make things more dangerous.
Well, even for a good bullfighter, it's probably a pretty big adjustment to add a third guy into a mix of an 8-second bull ride.
It can be, but at the end of the day, it goes back to your fundamentals and how sound you are on those, because it's all reaction and anticipation where that bull rider's going and what that bull's going to do. So even if I've never worked with a guy, if he's got good, solid fundamentals, ideally we're going to get along just fine because we're going to read off each other, feel off each other. And, you know, we're working not just with our front vision, but in our peripherals as well. So we're seeing everything that's going on and we're reacting to the situation at hand. We're not setting a game plan. I've worked with guys before that prefer the gate or prefer the latch or this is my side. I'm not about that. I can work all angles, and that's what, if I couldn't, then that's where I wanted to be so I could get better at it. So it goes back to them fundamentals. If you're sound on your fundamentals, we can step into a bullpen and really feed. Now, do I click better with certain guys? I think you can, but a lot of those guys that I named, you know, they're the elite of the elite, and you know, you jump in a bullpen with them, the excitement and the atmosphere just magnifies because you guys are just going out there, have fun. Yeah. And you know, we'll do what we call grab matches, and it's just getting a hold of bulls and just putting another level of entertainment in it for us, you know, instead of just keeping guys safe, and it helps keep your mind at ease and a peace about you when you're going about it.
Was Houston the first place you guys did three at a time? Or was that maybe one of the influential ones that kind of put three on the map?
Yeah, I mean, Houston was one in a sense. But a lot of them, it seemed like since I started going, a lot of the extreme bulls, or at least the division ones, had three. Now, you weren't necessarily working three so much. Even when I first got the NFR, we weren't really working tandemly in three.
Mm-hmm.
But I would always still kind of shadow in and float in there. And then, you know, Joe Bumgarner was really the guy who come up with it and the whole evolution of it. And, you know, after watching it and seeing how things are flowing, and just over time you find yourself seeing where you can step in and seeing where you can make your move and everything. So you put the right three guys out there, I mean, it's you have so much fun, and it's just you do take less steps because there's a third guy out there. So there is definitely some positives to it, and you can just go out there and have a heyday.
Yeah. It seems like 2021, the year that you did get hurt, like that was one of the first serious injuries that I've seen you have in a long, long time. How is it that you're able to do such a dangerous sport so often? I mean, it's different than bull riding. Bull riders will go maybe get on two or three one night if there's a long short in the same night, but like you're gonna fight all 40.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to fight 12, 15 a night, multiple nights. Fort Worth is multiple perfs in a day even.
Yeah.
So how do you go so long in one of the most dangerous events of the sport and not get hurt?
I think I credit a lot of it to my work ethic, for one. You know, there's several injuries that I've sustained throughout my career. That being one that actually had to sideline me. Like, there was no way around that. And I think that's what hurt the most, is knowing the magnitude of that injury. But I think, you know, it goes back to, I guess, you know, how bad you want it, as well as what are you putting in outside of the arena that can prepare you for the inside of the arena. So the gym and the nutrition and stuff that I go through on a daily basis isn't just so I can be in shape. It's for my longevity of my career. So push myself through those workouts and those discipline moments and times in my life, I think helped me callus me for when I get into the arena. So when I step foot in the arena, the hard work's done. I can just go apply what I've been doing and have fun. So
your workouts, they're really intense, and you sweat a lot. You work a lot. Are there any performances throughout the year that come close to the physical exertion that you're having to do in these workouts? Is it when you say that the hard work's done, like, is it really done as in, like, you'll never work as hard in the arena as you have in the gym?
That's kind of my mentality behind my training is, you know, I read, it was after you went with Cameron a couple weeks or a month ago or whatever, and I come across this deal that he said that, you know, I want my training to be harder than my hunt. And as I thought about it, I was like, man, that's kind of been my mentality through my career, is what I do outside the arena. I want to do so much over the top that when I get into that arena, there's no rhyme or reason that I should ever get to that point in that arena. Now, there's been times in the arena where you have a wreck after wreck after wreck, and you can't catch a break. You know, you're just, there's no pause. You know, you just keep rolling. But I credit that, going back to my work ethic in the gym, of, okay, I've prepared myself for this. I know I can do this, because for me, when I'm at the gym at my house, a lot of times I don't even put on any music or anything. It's just me in a cold gym or 110 degree gym, putting myself through those workouts. And so I know in myself, if I can push myself to complete exhaustion with no fans, no money, no nothing on the line, it's just me and a barbell or me and a treadmill, that when you get to the arena and the lights are bright and the production's hot and heavy and you got the announcers and the fans, you'll always rise up. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be so much easier to have that endurance and put it to use. So no, it's probably come close a time or two. There's some perfs where it's just like,
yeah,
you're in the meat seat every bull out, you know. But at the end of the day, that's why I put in those hours in the gym and you know, the different things that I put myself through to be able to capitalize, I guess.
It seems like with bullfighting, there's like flows, and some nights it'll, like, not only does everything flow to you, but you're also just, you can do no wrong. Mm-hmm. And then there's other nights where it doesn't flow to you and it feels like you can do no right. Is there anything you do when you feel like you're having one of those nights where it's not going right? Is there anything, like, do you have some sort of conversation that you have with yourself or a trick to try to, like, change that energy?
Man, I mean, you're really 100% right. Some days you are so good. Some days you just seem like you can't catch a break. But for me, every time I step in that arena, I just tell myself, you know, be aggressive and be blessed. Like, you know, the things that I can control are my aggression and the attitude that I step foot in this arena with. I can't always control every situation or predict every right moment where that guy's going to hit or what that bull's going to do or in a sense, get everybody saved. Now, that's my ultimate goal.
Yeah.
But the key thing that I really try to focus on is be aggressive. Even if I miss a shot on a hang up or I miss a gap, just stay aggressive, stay hustled, stay after it, get a hold, get deep, you know, and you got to have a short memory in a sense in this game of rodeo, fighting bulls, riding bulls or whatever. Because you can't let that affect the next bull or the next bull. You know, there's, like I said, contestants, they get on one animal a night or rope one steer a night or whatever, where I might have 15 or 50 bulls a night. So if I let one deal just totally zap me, then I've got a lot of other guys that are counting on me. And not that I'm not upset or want to critique and get better at that, what I did or what I did wrong. But I need to apply it to the next guy and the next guy. So just to really focus on the consistency of it in the process. And like I said, I think that all circles back around to the gym and the nutrition mindset that I have is just, why am I doing this? You know, there's a purpose and a reason for this. You know, I just don't like waking up every day and beating myself up. It's just like getting in the cold tub, the ice bath. It's never have got any more enjoyable.
Yeah.
But it's the chosen sufferings that I choose to go through that'll help prepare me for those unchosen sufferings. And the more I can do that, just the more you callous your mind and your whole thought process of it. And I think a lot of it's repetition, you know, fighting bulls, working out, whatever it is, you get in that mindset and that zone and you wake up every day and you crave more of that. You crave more of the pain. You crave more of what people say you can't do.
Yeah.
Because you want to ultimately prove them wrong. And you watch back film. I'm a big advocate of watching not just good film, but the bad film of areas where, I want to know. I want to be coachable. If this wasn't right, tell me. And then I want to work on fixing it. Because the more I can watch that situation and slow it down, the next time something similar happens in that arena, I'm already going to adjust to it before I even have a chance to think about it. And so that's really how I try to go about it on those days. And got to shake it off and dive back into the next one, you know. Almost just run in there, get hooked, get the cobwebs knocked off, and then you're like, all right, we're reset, let's go.
Sorry, everybody. It might sound a little, it might be a little loud with the rain.
Cooking popcorn.
We're finally getting some rain here. Yeah, the JR podcast.
Yeah.
Is that, dude, I think about him often.
Oh, yeah.
And, it was good to get to tell him and talk to him about that. You know, I'm sure there's not a lot of situations outside of a podcast where we were just going to bring that up.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly wasn't going to, but I think it's something that's in the back of every rodeo cowboy's mind. Maybe not in the very beginning, like how you described whenever early on you weren't scared, you know, like mm-hmm. you just weren't thinking about it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden the reality of what's at risk, mm-hmm. and then you do think about it. And I think that happens to all of us. Well, we get hit with that reality, and then we choose to move forward anyway. But I think there's still like a little bit of naivety that, you know, or maybe it's just hopeful that it's not going to happen to you, and then you mm-hmm. see it happen to a friend, we all hurt for him because we know what it's like to be passionate about this sport.
Yeah.
But, thank the Lord that he has a relationship with the Lord
mm-hmm.
and was able to, you know, battle that and, yeah. And now has a testimony and,
exactly.
But it's crazy to see the way, and I'm sure you can speak to it. Like I know I went years and years without any serious injury and it's crazy all the situations I've been in where I probably should have even died, mm-hmm. much less gotten broken up somehow. I'm sure you have a lot of those moments too. Yeah.
Several.
Yeah. What is in the arena, 14 years of NFRs, or even just those years that you're going, what's something in the arena that stands out story-wise?
Like at the finals or just...
Just a crazy something. Yeah, I start with the finals, but really just any arena moment. Like there's the time that you got flipped over backwards in Fort Worth, mm-hmm. landed on the chutes and walked off. That was, and then same thing happened at the NFR one year where you mm-hmm. did that like somersault on the, like the, is there anything, anything wild that just stands out that you feel yourself telling that story often and you don't think you'll forget it?
Man, I'd say, I mean, there's several from just the whole career, but some at the finals, a couple of them, two of them were bull rides that I watched. Two of my best friends, Cannon Acey and J.W. Harris. You know, Cannon, he ended up winning the 10th round, the average my first year on Big Iron. He's 93 points to sell the show. That was a big, cool moment to be a part of. And then, you know, fast forward a couple years later, J-Dub goes 94.5 on Smokescreen and Frontiers. And the friendships that we had throughout the years and still to this day hold strong. But to witness, you know, that for what was on the line and the prestigiousness of where we were at were pretty dang cool. But I'd say two things that are actually outside of the arena that really stuck to me was my first year there. Miles Hare was actually out there the whole time. And so every night after the perf, me and Miles would go back to the South Point there at the Coronado Cafe, and we'd watch the bull riding back and sit there and have dinner. And he'd tell me what he liked and what he didn't and what I could try different. And that was just a really cool moment for me because who Miles Hare was, he was the bull savvy man.
No kidding.
And to sit there, I would just go back in my mind of the countless times that I seen him work the NFR or what he's been through, and the mark that he's left on the sport. Was pretty dang cool, especially being my first year there, to be there with Smith or Miles every night. And then probably a couple years after that, I remember we were sitting there at the Island Bar, just probably watching the perf back, and Joe Bumgarner come up and sat beside me and just said some pretty good words. And the gist of it was, man, you deserve to be here. Keep doing you, and keep your nose to your ground, and keep doing you, man. I'm happy for you. And that was pretty cool because, again, up until that point, really, I don't know if I ever had any conversations with Joe. I knew who he was, obviously, admired him and watched him several years, the PBR finals, the NFR, and countless rodeos. And but those were really two moments that stuck into me with my career and the guys that come before me, and them to actually step down and say, hey, man, you know, you're doing good, and keep hammering. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. Dang. That's wild.
Yeah.
I like Miles.
Yeah. I'm like cocky. Miles a lot.
Yeah. He's I don't know. I'm watching tapes of him, you know, whenever I was younger. It was surreal to meet him in person, you know. But anyway, yeah, I don't think Bumgarner liked me. he did, at least that was my interpretation of him. My first interaction, the only interaction I had with him. But it's like, what do you think? What should I do to change? Because I was fighting bulls at the buck and stock sale.
Yeah.
He's like, man, just go out there and fight bulls. He turned around and walked off.
That's
like,
Bumgarner,
okay.
though.
Yeah.
I mean, I was like, you get to know him a little bit throughout the year. Like, he's a man of a few words. He just goes and does. And the few words that he has are usually cuss words. So,
right.
You got to know that about him. But yeah, Joe is a cool guy to be able to hear him and see him around it.
He fought Pendleton forever.
Yeah, several years, yeah.
Ever. And then did you fight it with him or you got it after
that? No, I never did work with Joe at all. I actually come in after Lloyd left, I believe.
Mm.
Yeah, so I ended up starting it with, it was myself and Donnie Griggs.
Yeah.
When I first got there, so that was another cool check of the boxes of rodeos I wanted to work, being a part of the dance of the grass.
So there's two ways you can get hired as a bullfighter. You can get hired by the stock contractor, or you can get hired by the committee. And it sounds like pretty early on you had a lot of committee hires. What made you decide? Was it exclusively committees and you didn't work for stock contractors, or was there a transition?
There was a transition. He's kind of out of the gate. You're more amped to probably get more contractor hires.
Yeah.
Just because a lot of them guys, when they're switching out from year to year or whatever, will hire somebody and ideally will probably try to hire them for their whole run.
Yeah.
And so you kind of get locked in with, you know, certain guys. And I never really wanted to just get locked down to a certain contractor.
I
worked for several, you know, I've worked for, you know, Powder River and Servies and Maury and Kessler's and Vold's and a handful others.
But do you think that made you more desirable? Because I feel like it would maybe a lot of guys be like, well, I need to do this to really get in with this stock contractor.
Yeah, and like I didn't really realize it at the time as I do now, but I really tried to tell, you know, the younger guys coming up, you know, don't not take jobs from a contractor that's wanting to hire you for the whole run or whatever, but you've got to be able to have that open-minded about, and hopefully that they do too, is if you start building your career and doing well and people are really starting to like you and these committees starting to like you, that you're going to get pulled a few ways. You know, some committees are going to try to pull you away, and sometimes, you know, the contractor is understanding and will let you miss out of that one or two rodeos or whatever, but sometimes they're like, all right, well, if you can't do them all, then we're going to replace you. And it's kind of a double-edged sword. Right. But again, going back to your investment, what you believe in your product, and there's definitely been some rodeos that I've had to lose because of, you know, I took some committee hires. But like I said, it's just understanding that, you know, there's an investment, a process that's going to go along. It's not going to come overnight. There's a lot of work that you got to put into it. And some of these rodeos, you know, I would talk to for years or see them at convention and never gave me the time of day. And, you know, and then 5, 6, 7, 8 years down the road, then I'd get a call or they'd come to my booth and want to hire me. So it's just, you know, always going back to, you know, Galatians 6:9, you know, don't grow weary for doing good, but in due time you'll reap a harvest if you don't give up. And that's just the mentality I try to tell a lot of young people is like, hey man, don't get down. Like this is a battle. And especially right now, there's, you know, a lot of big major rodeos that, you know, have your Websters and your Justice and your Harps and stuff like that, that are going to be, locked in for probably several years. So, don't look at it like, man, I'll never have a chance there. Not that you won't, but you're just going to be a little older when you do. And and like I said, you know, take opportunities when they come, whether that's contract hire, committee hire, but ultimately at the end of the day, you get a little bit more bang for your buck on the committee side of things. These obviously you're talking out of their pocketbook and what they're wanting to spend to get you there, and where contractors, you know, they're gonna, you know, nickel and dime you a little bit more. But that's just kind of the name of the game, and you've got to be willing to expand and not just stay in your own realm of, you know, one or two states or your circuit. You know, be willing to travel and go coast to coast, border to border, and all that stuff. So the more you're amped to do that, I think the better off you're going to have a career in the long run.
Do you remember specific times or how often did you get in trouble for being too aggressive after the bull ride?
I'm sure there's been a few times where I've had a contractor kind of get onto me. The one that I remember the most is we were in Abilene, Texas, and working for Benny Butler.
Yeah.
And, you know, he sells the rodeo with the Fighting Bull, and he used to have a Fighting Bull called Fender Bender. He's a paint Mexican that was around for years and was hard to get around, kind of sour. And, you know, a lot of guys didn't like fighting him, and I just went to him the whole, I don't know, 2-3 minutes or whatever until he opened the gate. And I thought I did really good. I was like, heck yeah, man. I didn't go up the fence. I didn't not fight him. And I made this mistake. I walked by Benny. I was like, man, what'd you think? Was that good? And he's like, gosh dang it, son. He said, I know you can fight bulls. He said, them fans in the stands that come to see that barrel get hit, you see, we don't need to see you fight him. We need to see that barrel get hit. So he jumped me for fighting his bull too much. So I kind of took that as a compliment more than an insult. But there's times you mess up a bull, and I definitely feel that I've been in the game long enough. I know when I do and don't know when I don't. Now, at the end of the day, there's a lot of contractors will try to tell you that you're messing them up, and you know, you kind of take it for a grain of salt. But when I know I do truly mess one up, I'm the first one to go up to that contractor and say, hey, man, my bad. I jumped the gun. I was in the way. I didn't do right. I apologize. And that happens. You know, contractors miss a flank every once in a while. And, you know, a roper misses a steer too, you know. So it's part of it. But, you know, I try to improve on every mess up that I do to not let it happen again.
It seems like there was a transition of like the times with bullfighters like turning bulls back.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems a lot less common now.
Mm-hmm.
Were you part of that early on in your career where you did turn bulls back?
Yeah. There was a handful of contractors that, you know, they'd have a step out there or try to latch one.
Yeah.
And you're right. You don't see it a whole lot anymore. I think, due to the fact of just a lot of the genetics, you know, they're kind of getting bred into it so much to where ideally if you're having to put a lot of work in the bull to try to get them turned back, they don't really waste a whole lot of time to keep feeding, you know? So, but yeah, I was kind of in that still a little bit of that era of, you know, stepping out there and turning one back.
It was an art.
Yeah, there was definitely an art. There were some guys that were really, really good at it. I wouldn't necessarily consider that I was one of the greats, but felt that I could do a good job of it and, you know, help them bulls out for the most part. But, yeah, shoot, I haven't been asked to latch one in years, it seems like.
Dang, yeah. Was it more common to latch one or grab him out in the?
Depending on the contractor. I never did like standing out in front of him.
Yeah.
I actually broke my ankle in high school doing that. A little really lunged out there at me, and I went to step around him. When he did, he belly rolled around and stepped on the side of my ankle and broke it. Yeah. So I didn't really like standing out there. I always would try to take my chances at the latch.
Yep.
And really just try to sneak underneath him. And that's one thing, watching old videos of Wickpeth, yep, that I really saw a lot was, boy, he'd really sneak underneath them on their drop when they're dropping, and be underneath them, and that bull would see him and drop that inside shoulder and come around to him, you know, being low and underneath where they could get a good visual of you. So I really try to do that a lot. There's times when you'd see Wick crawl out there literally on his belly.
Yeah.
And so there's times that I'd, you know, try to do the same thing, and it's a pretty cool feeling when you can get one turned back like that.
Has there been any of these big events or big rodeos or anything that you've, maybe a freestyle, something that you've had your eye on your career, throughout your career, that you haven't been able to accomplish?
Yeah. There's one bullfight that I could just never get won. It was Rex's bullfight in Ada, the world championships. I went there for several years and was the runner up three or four different times. And I just couldn't get her one, you know, and that was one that I always wanted to try to check off the box. And rodeo wise, man, I'd probably, the one that I'd say that I'd hopefully one day get a taste of it would be Calgary would be pretty cool. It's a, you know, if you know anything, a rodeo, Calgary is a big deal. And but overall, man, there's probably some more definitely out there that I'd like to, you know, try out, but they're just not going to work out in my schedule. You know, San Antonio would be cool, but you know, we're telling Fort Worth into Tucson, which are two great rodeos, and I'm so thankful and blessed to be a part of those. And but to experience some of the ones that I have is, you know, looking back at that kid on the arm of the couch, you know,
yeah,
staying up at midnight to watch the NFR on ESPN, I reflect back to that a lot, like, man, God, you're so good. And, like, I never would have thought in my wildest dreams that I would have been able to do some of the things I have and meet some of the people that I've, you know, considered my best friends now. You know, it's funny, the other night I was showing Austin Ashley I got the old rodeo card set. I don't know if you ever remember them or saw them before, but
Now that you mention it, I think I remember seeing like one recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But anyhow,
they had the whole rodeo set. There was the original set of cards were all white cards, and a lot of them were black and white.
Yeah.
And then there was the red set, and then the gold and silver crown set. And, you know, I remember a few years ago, that used to be what I did when I was rodeoing with Dad, is get the day sheet and go around and get my card signed.
Uh-huh.
And, man, I looked there, you know, a couple of years ago, and there's so many of them guys in there that have cards that I'm good friends with now that I call up right now. And so I need to pull them with me. But there's two that stood out to me the other night when we were looking at them, that I got Jim Shoulders assigned.
Dang.
And the Duke, Harry Vold, signed.
Dang.
So pretty cool stuff right there when you look back on your career and like, man, I remember when I was just that little punk kid running around trying to ask these guys for an autograph. And now, you know, Joe B and Joe Beaver and Tuff and Cody Custer and Cody Lambert and all these guys, you know, I know really well. And like, dang, and I need to pack them in my pocket and get them to sign them things.
Yeah, that's cool. It's cool to get to meet your heroes sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes.
A lot of my interns feel differently about that statement. So what's left to accomplish for you in rodeo?
Man, I don't know. I guess I don't really have like a big checklist. I think just I still feel that I got a lot of good years ahead of me. You know, obviously, you know, we
What's the oldest bullfighter that you knew? Like, how old was Miles or maybe Joe or some of them?
Yeah, I think Miles was pushing 50 or somewhere around there.
Yeah, it seems like it.
I think Frank retired upper 40s.
Yeah.
Corey Wall was upper 40s.
Yeah.
I can't remember how old Joe was, but they were definitely all upper 40s. So, like I said, I'm one of the older guys now, but I honestly feel like I'm still one of the young guys, you know, outside of some of the hardware that's in my body that I can feel. I still feel young and active and, you know, feel like I'm holding my own. I guess the goal more or less is just to keep staying consistent, keep doing my job, keep giving back to the younger generation. Obviously, you know, I've never got to work the PBR finals or anything. One of these days, hopefully I'll get a chance at that. If not, no big deal. You know, I've always been a rodeo guy, and I've worked real hard at a lot of the events that I've got to be at and partake in. So thankful and grateful for those committees. And, you know, like I said, every year is kind of a new year. You know, you're going to the same places a lot, but, you know, some of them are different anniversaries, and you know, the friendships that you get to develop at these committees, yeah. And that, man, it's what keeps the spice of life active, you know, kind of keeps that rookie rush that every weekend's a fun weekend, and you get to be – what better job can you have than celebrating everybody's big weekend, you know?
No kidding.
So it's – shoot, man, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, all these little towns, that's their party for the year.
Oh, yeah.
And you get to be at it.
Exactly.
Yeah. And some of them, though, they want you to party hard with them. And
yeah. And
you're more like bull riding's over. Let's get something to eat. Go to bed.
Especially
huh?
now. Like I said, I've never been that big of a partier unless it was in college. But, you know, yeah, now, you know, they're, hey, man, come on now. We got the best band you've ever heard.
Yeah.
Or, man, we got the best barbecue you ever had.
Yeah.
Man, going on 15 weeks of barbecue, you know.
Right.
But it, like
that's
kind
of how people expect me to be in Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
Where are we partying tonight? Man, that bull riding's over.
Yeah.
I'm going to be asleep at my Airbnb about 10 minutes later.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I don't get too crazy out there. My routine's usually been hang out at the arena a little bit after the perf, and then we usually go back and get a little bite and play some cards and socialize with
still,
the
you guys people. Still at South Point, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, still Mr. Gong and Ryan Growney, those guys.
That is the rodeo spot.
Yeah, those guys have been so... so over the top good to me and so many other athletes that, man, there's no way I could ever pay them back with everything that they've done for me. But
I love South Point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I took my grandmother out there a couple of years ago so she could play slots, and we never left. We just went to the South Point.
Oh,
just stayed there.
Yeah.
Like even when I'm visiting on vacation, that's where I went. But we did go, we snuck away and went to Hash House A-Go-Go in the Lynx. It's a breakfast place.
Sounds
maybe
good.
The best pancakes I've ever had. Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty good. But I'm not on pancakes right now. Dude, I want some of the pancakes.
Pancakes. You know, have you ever had cheese on your pancakes?
No.
I haven't either, but that's Bo Sheet, Nebraska deal, I guess. But, cheesy pancakes, I guess.
Well, Bo, you need to stop that.
Those sheets.
Yeah. So what's your routine like as far as your workouts and everything?
And there's really no routine. It's just a lot of high volume, consistently varied, high intensity functional training. Anything from swimming, biking, running, lifting, rowing, gymnastics, body weight, a little bit of everything. Try to, you know, work all the different muscles in different forms and fashions, from high burst energy to power output to endurance.
Yeah.
So just like I say, going back to training for the worst and hope for the best. That
right.
You know, when I get to that arena, that it can get crazy and get hectic, but I know that my body can withstand and able to do what I need to do and be able to keep my mind at ease and at peace. You know, being able to stay focused on what I'm supposed to do instead of trying to worry about my legs are giving out or man, I can't get my air. Oh my gosh, you know, type deal. So
right.
A little bit of everything. You know, like. After watching you on Cam's escapade, you know, coming off of last year, I've never really been a fan of running, at all in my life, actually. But I couldn't really run at all last year. Couldn't really jump. You know, I saved a lot of that pounding for the arena. So it was a lot lower impact stuff for me. But coming to this year, I really just, you know, actually we got back from Argentina on that stag hunt, and I was like, man. I was watching Cam and Dell and that. I was like, man, I need to just grow up.
Yeah.
Like, if it's gonna hurt, it's gonna hurt. And
right.
I set out for a goal this month, and it wasn't probably anything for some people, but I wanted to run 100 miles in a month, and I just creased over 115 miles with
Dang.
3 or 4 days to go. And like I said, a lot of that come off of you know watching your adventure up there in Eugene, and I was like, you know, man, if Cam can do it every day, and Dell can do it. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And just started running, and next thing I know, son of a gun, we're over 100 miles already. So
man, I wasn't much of a runner. Like, 2 miles maybe, you know, and then about a year ago, I went on Marcus Luttrell's podcast and started following. I knew of Cam Haynes, but really just started to diving into the content. And then, you know, everybody sees the clips of Goggins and like, man, I'm going to see what this is all about. And last year, I ran more last year than probably I have ever combined, you know, maybe. And yeah, it for me, it was like the mindset shift that it took to push myself beyond just the 2 mile. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good enough. Yeah. And it was like, I don't have any desire to enter a half marathon or full marathon or wear the suit. You know, that's not where if I'm going to compete, it's going to be at a rodeo.
Yeah.
Period. I don't really have any desire to prove myself anywhere else. And really even in the rodeo arena, it's for me. Mm-hmm. I don't really feel the desire to prove myself to anybody. Mm-hmm. I just love getting on bucking stock. Well, anyways, but knowing that like I didn't want to do it is what motivated me to like just internally like, man, I wonder if I can get myself to do this thing. Because I just had no desire to do it. And so setting out and I think it, you know, in high school you got a coach and military, you got a drill sergeant. But like when you volunteer, well, you volunteer for both those things. But the point is like just Tuesday morning, wake up early, nobody is telling you you have to go do this. It is you telling you, period. And it is okay if you back out.
Yeah.
But then not backing out, I guess. Yeah. And then it became annoying because, you know, this team never quit. Marcus Luttrell, that's his deal. And I had this damn bracelet on. And so I would, like, set out. All right, I'm going to do 4 miles today or 6 miles. And those are normally the higher numbers. Like, occasionally I do 8 or 9, but, like, that was rare. You know, normally it's either 4 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, once I set out to do it, like, I couldn't quit.
Yeah.
So I got careful to what I would set out to do, you know, because there'd be some days I'm sore, whatever. But that's all it was for me was like, and then there was the whole, you start your day with something hard and the rest of it's easy kind of deal. And, I don't feel like there's a certain level to be competitive at rodeo, where there's a lot of other things you can spend your time on. You know what I mean? Like, you don't need to, yeah, sure, it would help you to be good at running a half marathon to ride bulls. But if you're using all that time to train for that, you could probably also be getting on practice bulls. Yeah. You could probably also be there, you know, so I don't think it's a necessity to be successful in rodeo. And that's why I explain, like, for me, it was really just getting over that mental aspect of it. And also, like, if you get up and you get done working out and it's still dark outside, for, you know, in the morning, you didn't miss much.
No. I think ultimately you're right. Like, just the challenge, putting yourself through different challenges, adversity, the chosen sufferings, you know. But then there's a lot of that, you know, sports-specific training, you know. Know what you're training for, and that's why I always try to keep those priorities right of making sure I'm getting in what I need to get in for my sports-specific work.
Yeah.
And then, you know, nobody ever cussed anybody for putting in a little more, you know, go the extra mile, the old saying. So that's kind of what I would do. So this whole month, that's really what I've done is I'm going to make sure I get what I'm allotted to do for that's going to be more sports-specific training. And then I'm going to make myself, you know, go 30 minutes to an hour run or whatever it is and just start stacking those miles up. And just not that you're right. I don't care to go get into a marathon or anything like that. Some route runs or something would be kind of cool. Another just challenge to mark off the list. But ultimately, I'm not training for that. It's just something that, hey, you know what? You can't say I don't have time to do it. It was like you said, when you can get up and be done working out and that and it's still dark out, you didn't miss anything. It just goes back to discipline, you know, mentally and physically. And I think ultimately more now in my career from the physical side of things, the training and all that I do, the physical benefits are there for sure. But I think ultimately it's mental, more mental than anything. It helps callous my mind and prepares me for the day to come, you know, for those long, long, hard days or those unchosen sufferings that I was talking about that we can all face in our lives. And it just helps prepare you for the long run, not so much maybe for that season you're in, but, and then you also have a open outlook and perspective on life, that certain things that you may do or go through might not be just for you either. It may be that for that of another person. So having that kind of mindset of it too is like, you know what, I'm not training for no marathon or anything like that, but maybe that, you know, changes the trajectory of somebody's life in an area that they need it.
Yep.
You know, so it's not about us all the time. It's you know, about, you know, giving back and inspiring anybody around you, whether they're younger than you, same age or older than you. So that's kind of how I look at it. And, you know, like I said, I've never faltered or feared away and looked the other way from a challenge. I like experiencing new things and seeing what I'm truly made of, because like Goggin says, at the end of the day, when you feel like you're done, you're only at 40%. So there's 60% that we really don't even touch base on.
So not that it's coming anytime soon, but what do you see yourself doing after rodeo?
I'm going to stay involved in rodeo somehow. I don't quite know what exactly that is. It's not going to be contracting or anything, I don't believe. But also on the physical fitness side of things, you know, training some more athletes. You know, I train some guys here and there, but, you know, being more into the fitness world and those are kind of the angles that I really looked at or seen myself in for now. But, you know, got some different investment groups and stuff that we're in and different things like that to, you know, keep plugged into the friends and everything, the family. But those are kind of the areas that that have been on my mind more than anything. And
yeah,
but we'll just see where the cookie crumbles.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I understand. And having this much knowledge and insight about a sport like this, you know, that, and you've built your brand enough, like there will be, you know, a number of opportunities on the table for you whenever that time comes. So I'm sure you're not worried about it, and you shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. But for now, focusing on bullfighting up to this point is what's made you as great as you are. So there's no point in changing the old game plan there. Mm-hmm. But, well, where can we get the Dusty Tuckness 1513 hats you're wearing? That's sharp.
Appreciate it. We're in the development right now of getting more of a mass order, but getyourhooey.com, Hooey Sweet. Brand.
It's getyourhooey.com?
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, getyourhooey. And like I said, my whole concept and mindset behind this was, you know, going back to my injury in 2001. I actually had a
21.
Yep.
Yeah.
My hat patch made was just John 1513. Had that on my hat, and that 10th round, I got a text and pictures from, you know, Kate, who was at American Hat at the time, and then Nathan Harp, one of the other bullfighters that handed them out to a lot of people. And I've even still seen some still wear them to this day. And as I was sitting around rehabbing and just waiting to hit the ground running, literally, I just got to thinking about, you know, athletes that have been injured and what they go through. And it's part of it, part of the lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And just kind of started thinking of tinkering of a brand. And I come up with one, which I showed you, I believe, and I really liked it. But I felt it was just more like Western driven.
Yeah.
And to where, you know, me and Joey kind of sat down and kind of come up with this one, where it's, I feel like it's a logo you could almost kind of see anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so my whole vision behind it was to develop a brand of that spoke, you know, obviously spiritual, but hard work and discipline, you know, pays off. And be able to take, you know, majority of the proceeds and give back to injured athletes, you know, when they're, you know, on the struggles of, you know, recovering from, to get back to what it's going to feed their family. So that's kind of my whole vision behind it all and why I kind of wanted to build it. And, you know, we'll see where it takes off to. But like I said, at the end of the day, just another way I want to be able to give back to the sport that's given me everything I've had.
You bet. Well, check out Dusty Tuckness on all these platforms. Amazing story. Look out for him. Probably all over the Cowboy Channel. They're covering those bigger rodeos. And Lord willing, working his way potentially to maybe his 15th NFR. That'll be neat.
That'll be a blessing.
So look out for Dusty this year. and many more to come. So awesome story. Follow him there. Look out for these caps. And we're on to the next one. Thanks, Dusty, for coming out, my man.
You bet. Appreciate
On to the next one.